Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Thursday, March the 28th, 2024, one day before Good Friday and Easter weekend. Last week, we had the British academic Chris French on the show. He's an expert on what he calls the science of weird shit, why our minds conjure the paranormal. That's at least the subtitle of his new book, The Science of Weird Shit. And of course, Easter itself, at least for non-believers, is the weirdest of weird shit. The idea of resurrection, of death and then resurrection has become one of the central tenets of this monotheistic creed. Very interesting idea. One woman who has spent much of her career as an academic, another British academic, Candida Moss, studying the idea of the resurrection. She's the author of all sorts of interesting books, including Divine Bodies, Resurrecting Perfection in the New Testament and Early Christianity, Resurrection and the Afterlife in the New Testament. She has a new book out, very interesting thesis this week, God's Ghostwriters, Enslaved Christians and the Making of the Bible. And Candida Moss, who oddly enough teaches at Birmingham University in the UK, or the University of Birmingham as it's like to be called, but lives on the Upper East Side of New York, is joining us. Candida, congratulations on the new book. Chris French, of course, is not a believer. This idea of weird shit in religion, Chris and I talked about it when I interviewed him about his new book. Is the idea of the resurrection, at least for non-believers, is it exhibit A of weird shit?
Absolutely. If you're a modern non-believer, the resurrection of a dead body makes almost no sense. You'd have to assume that the person wasn't really dead when they were buried. In fact, in the 19th century, people did experiments to see if you were crucified, could you survive the experience and then possibly walk out of a tomb 3 days later? And the answer was yes, but it would be more like stumbling out of a tomb 3 days later.
Your new book, God's Ghostwriters, is about the darkness of life in the Roman Empire in part. I wonder why anyone in this world would want to be resurrected. Isn't death a better option than living in a world full of slavery and abuse and poverty and sickness?
Well, if you're resurrected in this world, then you're probably right. It wouldn't be so great. But in Christian tradition, the sort of general resurrection of everyone, that takes place at the end of time. And in the earliest accounts of what that will look like, it's much more like a party here on Earth. You know, there's unlimited food. You're just there with your friends. It's much more appealing. Things like suffering and death and sickness and enslavement, those have all been sort of done away with in Christian theology. So, you know, for Christians, it looks more positive. But if you were brought back to life just to sort of go back to the mill, that would be very different.
Yeah, that vision of infinite food reminds me of my mother-in-law's Easter, which certainly is quite an experience, my Christian mother-in-law. Let's get to the book, Candida, God's Ghost Writers, Enslaved Christians and the Making of the Bible. The thesis is incredibly intriguing. Tell me what you are arguing in this new book.
So the book's really about the work that was being done behind the scenes. So we attribute the books of the New Testament to this sort of cluster of authors, most of whom have ties to Jesus himself or their apostles themselves, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, Peter. And that's who we think wrote those texts. But that's actually not even what the New Testament says about who wrote those texts. when you think about just Christian tradition, we're talking about largely illiterate fishermen and craftsmen who couldn't possibly have written these texts. And so they would have needed to have used other people to read and write. And that was really common in antiquity because very few people had been educated. Even those people who had been educated often needed glasses and didn't have them. And people who hadn't been educated would then turn to others who they would rent to read and write for them. And most of those people were enslaved or had been enslaved formerly in their life.
It's an interesting thesis, but so what? So if the formal people we associate with the Bible didn't quote unquote write it, and the fact that it was written by slaves and artisans and perhaps even women, what does that tell us? Does it reflect perhaps the message, the arguments, the nature of the Bible? Were they actually writing it or were they transcribing it in your view?
So they were definitely taking dictation, and I spent a lot of work looking into that and how that worked. And dictation wasn't like dictation today. It's very fluid and active. So they would have participated in the writing of these texts. And then in copying them, they would have made changes. In reading them aloud, they would have really interpreted those texts. So I do think they were actively involved. It makes a difference, obviously, to Christians. If you're a Christian and now you learn there's a whole group of other people who are involved in writing the most important text in your world, you could see why that would suddenly be very important. You'd want to know more about them. But generally, when we talk about any kind of text, be it Shakespeare or Charles Darwin, we want to know what they intended. What did Darwin think he was saying when he said this? What was Shakespeare implying? And we all took exams in school asking us that question. When we say, what does this mean? We really are asking, what does the author mean? And if the author is now a larger group of people, some of whom were enslaved, we have to ask, what are they bringing from their lives to this text, and how might they be sort of shaping the story in light of their experiences and their education?
What is the consensus, Candida, amongst scholars? I know this is a huge subject, a very controversial subject, about the writing of the Bible.
Well, so the general consensus, what everyone will agree on, is that it's written by a whole group of people, and you would struggle to find any sort of trained scholar, an academic, who thought that all of the books of the Bible were written by the people that they claim to have been written by. It was very common to write in other people's names. And at this point, you'll run into some disagreement about who people actually thought wrote these texts and who those authors were and when they were writing them. But the general agreement for the New Testament is that Paul's letters were written first in the 40s and 50s. And then between the 70s to sort of 120, the rest of the New Testament was written down by people who were as much as sort of 50 years removed from the life of Jesus and often had never actually met him. And we're just sort of putting down traditions that they had heard from others. And obviously, people who are believers, that can be quite challenging because anyone who's ever played a game of telephone knows how messages can get messed up quite easily.
What's your take on, quote unquote, and this is obviously another enormously controversial subject, the truth in the Bible story or the Bible, the narrative? Is it built around truth in your view?
So there's a real person here at the heart of the New Testament. There is a Jesus. There was a Jesus who clearly inspired other people, and people wrote down his message as best they were able, but they were also writing 2,000 years ago. And if you just look at sort of ancient history writing, how did people write history? Well, we have historians who say things like, so Thucydides, who tells us the story of the Peloponnesian War, very famous history book, supposed to be the first history book ever. He tells us, well, you know, I spoke to people, but if I didn't have a source and I knew someone made a speech, I wrote down what they should have said. And today, that is in no way history writing. You don't just make up a speech as if it happened. And so I think, you know, people are writing things down, but they aren't actually even trying to write things precisely because they don't live in this particular period where we care about the precision. They're trying to convey a message, often to people in a variety of different places in the world who have different kinds of cultural contexts. So, for example, I'm from England. When I came here and people were trying to explain American football to me, you know, I was like, could you explain this in light of rugby to me? That would really help. And it was the same with the Jesus story. You're trying to explain the Jesus story to someone who lives in the city of Rome, but who does know the story of the Odyssey, then you might try and explain it in those terms. And so there's some truth here. But certainly, if you were a fundamentalist who thought that every word of the New Testament was sort of inerrant, I couldn't get behind that at all.
So where does the story come from? I was in Ephesus last year in Turkey, visited supposedly the home of Mary Magdalene, I think, theoretically at least, was Jesus's mother. Who built the particular narrative of his life, the idea of the Immaculate Conception, and then his death? Where did it come from, this story?
Yeah, so what you're alluding to is sort of thousands of years of tradition. Certainly, like if you're visiting the house of Mary Magdalene or the house of Mary, the mother of Jesus, that's just somewhere that people 400 years later thought maybe this was the house, and often that house wouldn't have been discovered for another 1,000 years.
But it wasn't much of a house, I have to admit. Experience, just another house.
Right, but the sort of the basic building blocks of the story. So our first gospel is the Gospel of Mark, and that actually has no birth story at all in it. He just shows up, he's on the banks of the River Jordan, he's shown up to hear John the Baptizer, who was a very popular teacher at the time. And he gets baptized and he hears a voice from heaven and there's a dove and he's acclaimed as God's son. And that kicks off his own teaching activity. But we don't actually know anything about his birth before then. In fact, we don't know anything about his father at all. We just know that he's the son of Mary and he's a construction worker. And it's not until Matthew and Luke are writing sort of somewhere between 10-30 years later, that we get a birth story for Jesus that makes him sound a lot like a sort of very sanitized, puritanical version of the birth story of just a Greek deity. So instead of Zeus having relations with a human woman and a demigod being born, you have sort of this kind of Holy Spirit-infused conception project. And then Mary gives birth to a child, even though she hadn't had sex. Fun fact, the Immaculate Conception actually refers to the conception of Mary, the mother of Jesus. But no one knows that. I once had to fight with an editor about it. And then the other elements of the story, the miracle stories, the traveling around, those kinds of stories, those miracle stories, are told of a lot of people in antiquity. We see this as weird now. You talked about weird shit at the beginning of this. We say those stories.
The science of weird shit. I'm not sure if it's a thing, but Chris French thinks there is.
Yeah, but sort of in antiquity, these stories weren't as remarkable as they are to us. We hear them and we're like, scientifically, how is this possible? But in antiquity, you'll have sort of good scientific writers telling stories like this. And you'll think, well, this isn't science at all. So this was sort of much more common in the ancient world. What's strange about the Jesus story is how he dies. Because in the earliest version, it's a humiliating death. This is how you punish disobedient enslaved people and traitors. And the way that the story is told is also quite embarrassing. Like the Gospel of Mark will not let you look away from the pain on the cross. Whereas if this was the death of a Greek or Roman hero, they'd go down with sort of a comedic last words, like a James Bond kind of parting.
Or a Monty Python.
Exactly, right? But Jesus doesn't do that. To say that Jesus is sort of dies like a little girl is wrong, because little girls in Greek epic die better than this. And so that's really stunning and probably appealed to a lot of people at the time who had suffered at the hands of Roman military might in the region. And that's probably part of why it was appealing at the time. But the sort of elements for the story often draw upon sort of Greek and Roman literary conventions. These are the kinds of stories that people liked. If you think of horror movies, today. You know, once you've seen a few, there are elements you recognize, like don't go into the basement, for example. And that's the same with these kinds of stories in the ancient world.
Yeah, it goes back to your metaphor of American football and rugby and their being somehow related, although actually the more you watch American football, I think the more it seems like war rather than rugby.
This is true.
And of course, it's called American football, but it's nothing like the football that everyone else calls football around the world. So coming back to these narratives, the Jesus story is one where God comes down to earth in the conventional sense. It has, I guess, an element of Roman, stoicism in it. Mm-hmm. What about Greek philosophy and politics? You imply, you get us to a little bit of politics in terms of his death on the cross as a consequence of perhaps some political events or some sociological suffering. Is the Jesus story in any way borrowed from political philosophy of antiquity, whether it's the Greeks in particular, of course? I mean, there's certainly a Socratic element here. In some ways, the figure of Jesus brings to mind the figure of Socrates and his own death. And then, of course, some of the Roman political philosophies of turning away from the world. I mean, maybe they're not political philosophies, they're apolitical philosophies.
Yeah, the death of Socrates, definitely. The Gospel of Luke's version of the Easter story is deeply influenced by Socrates and how he dies. Definitely Jesus in that story becomes a lot more stoic, a lot more self-controlled, almost funny the way Socrates is. And so that's certainly the case.
But I know this is a word that you've spent a lot of time thinking about, very much of a martyr.
That's right. And for Christians, the Jesus story obviously becomes sort of building block for describing the deaths of other Christians who die like him. And they also borrow from Socratic tradition. Before the death of Jesus, you already have a kind of martyrdom idea out there in Greek philosophy, in ancient Jewish literature with the Maccabees, and just in the deaths of sort of Roman generals and, you know, heroes from the Trojan War. There are a lot of people who had thought about what it means to die well. And Jesus may become sort of the first martyr figure and the most iconic martyr figure for Christianity. But there were lots of people who bought into the idea that you should be willing to suffer and die for something you believe in.
Yeah, and of course, much has been made. You yourself have studied this, the persecution of the Christians. Perhaps one of the reasons why they were so violently persecuted by the Romans was that it was a challenge on certain narratives of antiquity. Perhaps it was a defense of the gods.
Yeah, I mean, I've written, you know, 3 books about martyrdom and persecution, so I have thought about it quite a bit. I think that the Romans, they didn't really persecute Christians in the sense of seeking them out for quite some time, but when they come across them and they talk to Christians, Christians sound enormously countercultural. So when you have a Roman judge in a courtroom, as you do in the middle of the second century, you have this group of Christian sort of philosophically interested people in his courtroom, led by this man named Justin. And one of them is an imperial slave. And this enslaved imperial worker says, I was an imperial slave, but I've been freed by Christ. Maybe he means it metaphorically. But to a Roman judge, that's a pretty big challenge to power. If another one says, oh, I have an emperor, he's the emperor of the universe, he's Christ, that sounds like treason to a Roman judge. And, you know, you punish traitors with execution. So from a Roman perspective, they were just very annoying. And you really can't let people get away with saying things like this.
And also it probably adds to Christian's sense of the truth or significance of its own narrative if they were persecuted. If they weren't, then people wouldn't have taken them as seriously.
Absolutely. Christianity, you know, begins to develop this idea that they get from the death of Jesus that being persecuted is a sign that you're right and a sign that God supports you. And that idea continues all the way into the present.
Some people might suggest it's a history of sadomasochism. Anyway, that's another subject, another show, another book. We're talking with Candida Moss, one of the world's leading scholars of Christianity. She has a fascinating new book out, God's Ghost Writers. I want to thank, not God's Ghost Writers, but my friends at Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, for, they're not rewriting the Bible, but they're doing a good job in terms of writing about culture and politics, and they support this show. Going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Candida Moss to talk about God's ghostwriters, and particularly the role of enslaved Christianities and the idea of slavery in the making of the Bible and of Christianity. So don't go away, anyone. We're all watching you. God is ubiquitous.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We are speaking with Candida Moss, the author of God's Ghostwriters, fascinating new book out about the making of the Bible and the role of enslaved Christians in its writing. Candida, when I saw the title of the book, it occurred to me that someone had come up with this thesis more than 100 years ago, the idea of the master-slave morality at the heart of Christianity was something that Nietzsche suggested, not perhaps as historically as you did, in his On the Genealogy of Morality. Is there a Nietzschean quality, at least, to this interpretation of the writing of the Bible?
Yeah, so Nietzsche's theory. He's right in as much as enslaved people played valuable roles in the rise of Christianity. And what he's really talking about isn't the sort of historical fact of enslaved Christians and their roles. He's talking about the fact that Christianity is a sort of a set of cultural values, encodes this sort of master-slave morality that he certainly doesn't really support, and others have also seen as somehow deficient, not powerful enough. You know, when you think of Nietzsche, you think of will to power. And Christianity certainly does sort of, it cherishes people who are suffering, it cares about the downtrodden, it wants to see people care for widows and orphans. So these are the kinds of values that you find encoded in the New Testament. The most consistent message in the New Testament is care for the poor. And so that's really what he's talking about. And you can see those values as deriving from the enslaved people involved in Christianity. They were also values that were shared by prophets in the Hebrew Bible as well. So Christianity doesn't have a monopoly on care for the downtrodden.
Slavery, of course, has a particularly racialized meaning in America. But in Rome, and perhaps you can talk about this a little bit, slavery wasn't racial. I mean, there was perhaps a racialized element, but it wasn't solely racial, and it was much more ubiquitous than even slavery in 18th century America. Perhaps you might talk a little bit about what slavery was in Rome and the role of what you call enslaved Christians in the writing of the Bible.
Yeah, so slavery in antiquity wasn't using the same kind of racial theories that emerged in sort of the colonial period. But Roman slavery, because it was driven primarily by war, it did mean that it might incidentally take on sort of phenotypical contours, by which I mean sort of when Julius Caesar conquers modern day France, Gaul, in the first century BCE, a million Celts were enslaved, and they became famous for their sort of red wavy locks. So you could have certain kinds of bodily characteristics associated with enslavement, but it wasn't race-based in the way that modern slavery is. It was more about status and power and So you have a lot of people who are enslaved, but unlike sort of Atlantic slavery, which is what we tend to think of, when we think of slavery, they did educate their enslaved workers. And there are a number of reasons for that. They don't have electricity. And I think anyone who gets to a certain age knows it's actually quite hard to see at night. They don't have glasses, which means anyone with congenital visual problems or age-related vision loss would not be able to read or write at a certain age. And also, writing really hurts. And so when it comes to things like copying down text, taking courtroom notes, they wanted to educate enslaved workers to do this labor for them. They find it more pleasant to be read to than to read for themselves. And this means that when it came to people who were doing the work of reading and writing, most of those people were enslaved or had been enslaved earlier in their life and had then been set free later on. And what that means is that for anything that's being written down or copied or read aloud, most of those things are being read or copied or read aloud by enslaved people. And that is as true for early Christianity as it is for inhabitants of the Roman Empire in general.
It's a fascinating idea, Candida, because of course it's the reverse of the situation of literacy and books in the medieval world, where you had these scribes, monks, whose power was perhaps rooted in their ability to read and write. How did this intersect with power? Was it a reflection of powerlessness? And it's a very radical, I have to on this rewriting of the history of writing and reading.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting, the medieval scribes also complain about the labor of reading and writing. They say it causes kidney problems, among many other issues that they get. But when it comes to sort of the status and power, being able to read and write is a real status marker, which is why if you've ever been to Pompeii, you'll see sort of images of people holding scrolls and books and pens. But that doesn't mean you want to do the work, even if you've learned to read or write. That doesn't mean you want to actually do it. And as far as they're concerned, and we sort of have this idea too, you're the author of something if you authorized it. So if you write something and you dictate it to someone else, regardless of how much work they do, if that person's enslaved, you get to take credit for their work, just in the same way as people do in companies today. And, you know, we've all had that experience of someone taking credit for our idea. It's quite frustrating. But in the Roman world, you're the author if you authorize it. You don't have to write it down yourself. And so there is a lot of status attached to literacy, but they see the enslaved workers doing the sort of actual hard grind as sort of mindless extensions of themselves as tools or body parts. The word amanuensis for a secretary, the Latin, which we still use today, comes from the Latin for manus, a hand. And it really conveys this idea that your secretary is just your hand, but they're just walking around. And so even if they're doing the work, you still feel that you wrote it. And that's sort of one of the way they're obscured.
Was it considered, borrowing another word from Chris French, was it considered shit work, this transcription of other people's ideas?
Well, copying was considered that kind of work. Copying is sort of so awful that no one would want to do it. Writing in shorthand is seen as sort of degrading, they say. So that kind of labor is considered bad, but also sort of they don't even really think that those people are doing anything. If an enslaved person tried to be an author, they would then say that they're incapable of doing that. They just don't have those intellectual skills, and they would describe that as shoddy.
If your thesis, Candida, is correct, what does this tell us about Christianity? Does it give us, at least in our perhaps obsession with slavery these days, more dignity, more truth, more meaning to Christianity? Does it tell us anything new about this monotheistic faith?
It tells us a lot of new things about what the message of the Bible is, what these stories are actually about, and who's responsible for them. You know, Christians obsess over every word of scripture. You know, you have a participle, you mistranslate it, and boom, you have another denomination of Protestantism all of a sudden. And this has happened. So, you know, every word is important historically for Christians. So there are really high stakes there. And once you change who you think the authors are, you start reading those stories very, very differently. I wouldn't say that the presence of enslaved workers in antiquity and the role of disseminating Christianity is somehow dignifying Christianity. Christianity doesn't ban slavery. They have enslaved workers and they continue to have enslaved workers. The Bible played a huge role in perpetuating slavery, certainly in the debates in the American South. So it doesn't at all let Christianity off the hook to have them involved. And really, as a book, it's about invisible labor and about what looking at those people does to our understanding of history and writing in antiquity and what the Bible actually has to say.
Speaking, Candida, of invisible labor, the New York Times Review, you got a very nice New York Times Review this week, as the New York Times always does, makes your book relevant in terms of the contemporary age, maybe even the age of our precariat, essential workers, emotional labor, precarity, the review talks about. Does this, or your interpretation of this rereading or rewriting of the Bible, does it tell us anything about the America of the 2020s?
Certainly for me, those were things that occurred to me when I was working on the book. You know, I wrote it in the pandemic and I'm in New York City. And like everyone, you know, I stayed home. I felt really good about myself. You know, I'm like a good moral person because I stayed home so that we didn't spread the virus. I actually had to because I'm immunocompromised. So I'm feeling really good about myself. But the reason I can do that is because I'm having things delivered. And when I talk about that, I say Amazon delivered whatever. But Amazon is sort of a multinational conglomerate. It doesn't actually, it's not a person. It didn't deliver anything to me. That was a person who was put in harm's way on my behalf so I could have, you know, toilet paper or potentially mascara. You know, so we do a number of these sort of rhetorical moves that the Romans do. We do that too. We kind of obscure what we consider to be low status labor as well. And so for me, it did make me think about how I was talking about things. You know, when we talk about having, you know, our kitchen redone, we say, oh, I'm redoing my kitchen. But like most people are not renovating their own kitchen. They're paying people to do that. And even if they make decisions about cabinets or appliances, there are so many other decisions that are being made by other people who are specialists. And we do that in the present. We should probably think more about that.
So rather when we read the Bible and go to these ceremonies over the weekend, we should be thinking not about the blood of Christ, but the blood of the writers of the Bible.
We should certainly be thinking about the many, which is what the Jesus story wanted us to think about, the many other people who experienced casual violence in the ancient world. And we should be asking ourselves what this meant to the people who wrote it and why this was important to them.
It's a wonderful story, isn't it? I mean, whether or not you believe it, Candida, and it's astonishing that it caught on. That we're still arguing about it, that you've built a career like so many other people on interpreting and reinterpreting the Bible. Will this go on forever? Is it going to go away one day? A lot of people thought in the 19th century that it would, but it doesn't seem to have.
Yeah, I mean, it really, Christianity shouldn't have succeeded. There were many other people who claimed to be the Messiah in first century Judea who were then executed as Jesus was, who had much bigger followings. And being executed in this way, this should really put a stop to a movement. It's really stunning that it survived, that it grew, that it took over the world and became the most powerful religion in the world for such a long period of time. Will it go on forever? You know, things always feel inevitable when you're in them. There have been many moments, you know, in the 19th century, in the 1950s, where people have proclaimed the death of Christianity, and it's certainly on the decline in developed countries. Certainly Christianity is now in a position where it has to share, particularly with agnostics and atheists. I don't think it's going anywhere within our lifetime, that's for sure.
Forever is a long time. I hope your book will piss people off. I mean, any good book will piss people off. Of course, the evangelical movement in the US is very strong and very conservative, often associated with Donald Trump and his Trumpian wing of the Republican Party, a very white, perhaps white working class wing. Not everyone likes. We've done lots of shows on this. Do you think that some evangelicals in America in particular will be offended with what you're arguing here, that the Bible was written by slaves?
I think they will, you know, and I think part of the reason for that is, you know, I've done a lot of work that has annoyed them before. So I don't think that
good work, Candido. We applaud you for that.
Thank you. So I think that I'm not exactly a trusted friend. I don't think it should, but I think it will, because people don't like thinking about things in new ways or being challenged to think about things in new ways. So even though I don't think this idea should be threatening, and the idea that the Bible was collaboratively authored with enslaved people is only a problem if you really think enslaved people are lesser than other human beings, that doesn't mean there won't be people who are offended by it, because, you know, people don't like being challenged.
Final question. Of course, Christianity wasn't the only faith those days. There was also Judaism, which perhaps Christianity was a fragment of, a splinter of. We got a show next week with Shay Held, a new book, Judaism is About Love, which has been very well reviewed, controversial as well. A couple of final questions. How does this all fit in with the original monotheistic creed, Judaism? And how does it play out in terms of love, which often is seen as the central ideological tenet of Christianity?
Yeah, so Christianity does start out as just a sort of branch of Judaism. But Jesus himself was Jewish, his first followers were Jewish. It was Paul who took this message to Gentiles and said, come join us. Not that Judaism was particularly, you know, delighted with the emergence of Christianity. It wasn't even until the end of the first century that they were being called Christians. So definitely it's an offshoot of Christianity, particularly in the emphasis on love and forgiveness and care for others. Those are ideas Christianity gets from Judaism. But it very quickly...
Sorry to interrupt here. I mean, and is Easter in itself a kind of universal reinterpretation of Passover?
It is definitely a riff on Passover and makes no sense without it. As a story, it's grounded in the Passover story, in liberation. Jesus is the Passover lamb. Without that, so many elements of Christian tradition wouldn't exist. But it is a story that we could say is universal, but there are stories in other traditions that are universal too. The fact that you have a dying and rising God, that's not a unique Christian claim.
Final question, you're an Anglo-American like me in the US, and one of the things that really disappoints me, I'm not a Christian, but you have to live through Easter, you can't avoid it. In the UK, there's a very strong tradition of eating chocolate Easter eggs. Why aren't there chocolate Easter eggs in the US? What's happened here? It seems a very disappointing development.
You know, I have to say, I'm the Cadbury professor at Birmingham, you know, from the family.
Yeah,
but truly, the only chocolate that I would eat before this was Cadbury's chocolate, too. So you can import them, is the thing I will say. And, you know, I'm not so subtly trying to push Easter eggs on my children and all of their friends. So this is, I think, you know, one of the ways in which America has failed to make good on its promise, not having chocolate Easter eggs.